RadioInfluence.com.
He got him in the white trunks. He heard it.
That's beautiful. Oh, God. That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the top. Wow. And here's Lucas as I mentioned. And it's all over. It's all over. First round knockout.
Big
is how Rich Franklin retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
Welcome to the December 19th edition of the MMA Report podcast with Dale Galvan. I am Jason Floyd. Come up here on this week's edition of the podcast. We're going to take a look back at all the fights that took place last weekend. Bellator 211, UFC on Fox 31. And Bellator 212. Speaking of UFC on Fox 31, we'll talk to two of the winners from that fight card. You'll hear my conversation with Zach Otto as he recaps his win against Dwight Grant. Also, you're going to hear from Mike Rodriguez, who recaps his win over Adam Milstead and drops a little nugget about that finishing combination he used when exactly he decided to start when he realized he was going to throw it in the fight. So very interesting from him. Plus, I'll chat with Walt Harris, who's going to be taking on Andre Arlovsky next weekend at UFC 232. Plus, the final interview will be with Travis Davis, who's going to be fighting for the inaugural middleweight title on Saturday at Pinnacle FC 18. Had a chance to catch up with him, talk to him about his career. Plus, we are going to talk about the article that appeared on ESPN.com on Monday where Nick Diaz denies that he's accepted a fight at UFC 235, which absolutely no one should be surprised by that. But Daniel, how you doing, man?
Jason, I am doing quite well. It feels like the calm before the storm this week. It seems like every time there's a big UFC event on the horizon, there's always almost like a week off. And that's what we get before John Jones returns to the cage. But I got a question for you, Jason. I know you are a man who is in the bar scene. And that's in terms of the business side, not necessarily the drinking side. But Jason, I do have a question for you.
All right, well, go ahead, fire away.
Okay, so Saturday night, I went out drinking with some friends, and we decided to go to a bar establishment. And obviously, Saturday night was the same night as Canelo's fight. Now, I'm no boxing fan, but I feel like this wasn't the most competitive contest in the world, as he takes on Rocky Johnson. But they had a cover charge, $7, to watch the Canelo fight. Now, as someone who knows stuff about bars and how much it costs to buy a pay-per-view and stuff, when something's on DAZN, is there a charge by a bar to justify a $7 cover?
Well, I do know that DAZN was selling it to commercial establishments. They announced that, I want to say, within like the last 3 or 4 weeks. We never got a phone call on it, so I don't know what they were charging. It's all based on your seating capacity. I mean, how big of a place were you at?
I don't know. It wasn't a huge bar, but it was definitely medium sized, whatever that means. I mean, you know, there was probably about, let's say, 100 customers there.
Okay, yeah. I mean, you know, obviously, in boxing pay-per-views tend to be more expensive than MMA pay-per-views are, so I'm sure that probably has that. Do you know if that place has shown UFC before? Have they done a cover charge for that?
I don't know, but it's just, is it not different because it's on a subscription service?
Well, you're still, as a bar, you're not paying $10 a month to show the zone, okay?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
My guess is, you know, I mean, look, for them to justify a cover charge, I mean, obviously they kind of felt that they had to because, you know, they felt that, you know, maybe they've been burned on boxing pay-per-views in the past where, you know, they've shown it and, you know, people come in and they just don't put money into the bar. I mean, that's the thing in the bar business. When you show these pay-per-views and you don't do a cover charge, you are counting on the fact that those people that come in to watch the fights are going to put money into the bar. And yeah. I will tell you, there are times where you sit there and you see people who come in and they really don't put any money into the bar, and that it leaves a bad taste in your mouth if you're the place that's showing it.
That makes some sense. I will say my one criticism is that you knew you were watching a fight in the Rio Grande Valley on DAZN because throughout the Canelo fight, by God, there was buffering buffering on all the big screens. Yeah, I don't even get that in my home when I watch DAZN. But no, yeah, that was.
Anytime I've watched DAZN live, I've never had any streaming issues. I'll tell you, one of the things I love about DAZN is, especially because I didn't watch Bellator 213 live, was just the ability to, you know, how they have it where you can just watch whatever fight you're looking for. If you want to watch the McFarlane Letourneau fight, you can watch that, or if you want to watch another one of the fights, that's one of the things that I do love about the DAZN product. But you know, one of the things that I did hear about the Canelo fight was squash match. Would that be about the best way you would describe it?
Yeah, man. When a fight ends, as soon as it did, I mean, that's what I expected. But that's the book, right? That's going to be the book on Canelo fights on DAZN. I mean, that's what I was explaining to people when I was at the bar, like. Mm-hmm. They'd be like, "Oh, Canelo, what's DAZN?" I'm like, "I made that mistake."
I tell you, I saw a Twitter bunch of tweets where people were still saying, "I still don't know how you say DAZN," which I ultimately say that's awful marketing by whoever came up with the name.
Yeah, whoever came up with the name is awful marketing. I mean, this thing's becoming popular because they bought a lot of content. And people want to watch what's on DAZN, but the way it's spelled is just, yeah, it's rough.
I think DAZN is going to be a major player in sports broadcasting rights. I saw a thing the other day where it was talking about when the AAC football rights. Now the AAC, that would be most UCF is the, you know, the champion out of that conference in football. I want to say their media rights are up like in a year or two. And it was mentioning that DAZN's going to be a player. And we've seen DAZN be a player in the MMA landscape. I mean, look, I cut the cord a couple of weeks ago. And so DAZN is how I watch the Bellator product. And I'll tell you, it's, you know, I was watching the Bellator event on Friday night. So I'm watching on DAZN. And I saw Jedi Goodman put a tweet out. He goes, "I think I've seen an H&M commercial now 39 times during this broadcast." And then Aaron Bronster basically said, "Yeah, there's about five commercials up here in Canada in rotation," which I don't see any of those commercials. It's just you either get just a straight live feed, or they're playing various Bellator digital videos that you can see on Bellator's YouTube channel. Like there was one about, it was like what fighters are putting on their Instagram account or things along those lines. So for me, it's great because I get the chance to see Bellator live. But man, I will tell you, that broadcast on Friday night, Danny, we're both in the broadcast industry, me doing radio and podcasting, you doing television work there in the Rio Grande Valley. I think you probably have kind of the same mindset that I do. After a broadcast is over, and I've had this mind since being in broadcasting since 2002, when you end a broadcast, you kind of say, "We had a really good broadcast," or, "Oh, man, we could have done things a little better here." And I don't know how someone who put together Bellator 212 on the production side walked away from that broadcast and said, "You know what, fellas, we had a good broadcast."
I mean, it all starts and ends with the pacing issues, right? Like, what time did that show start, and what time did that end?
It started at 10 p.m. Eastern time, ended at 1:30 a.m. Eastern time for five fights. Five fights. Four of them are scheduled for three rounds. And, of course, the main event does go all five rounds, and we'll talk about that in a momentarily, but it was... There was a point in that broadcast where, okay, so the third fight, which was, I want to say, the AJ McKee fight off the top of my head.
Yes.
It started at the 105-minute mark of the broadcast. So we're over an hour and a half into this broadcast, and the third fight is just starting. There was a moment where I was like, do I just go to bed and just, because look, I was there to watch Chandler Primus. That was what got me to the television set on Friday night. And ultimately what I ended up doing, it ended up being background noise. I said, you know what, screw it. I've got to get on a plane tomorrow to go to Baltimore. Let me get some of my social media work done for the weekend. And so it really, from that moment on, from basically the 90-minute mark on, it was background noise until Chandler Primus started. And it's just, I hope Bellator looks at the criticism that they got on social media about the pacing and takes it to heart and doesn't take it as, oh, those people are just being negative Nancys. I hope they're just being honest about it, because just as a consumer of MMA, And look, I understand what that show was. That show was a salute to troops. We're going to, you know, put, you know, a lot of things about what's going on in the military in Hawaii. I understand that. But also, you have to look at it from the home viewer experience. I mean, we talk about how the pacing of UFC broadcasts on FS1 is awful. That might have been the worst pacing I've ever seen in an MMA event.
And it's just like, at the end of the day, when you're putting on a broadcast, it's a pretty simple premise. You are putting on things on your TV in order for people not to change the channel. A broadcast like that encourages the viewer to change the channel. You watch something that's paced that way, and there's so much time in between fights where there's no fighting and the content itself isn't particularly riveting, even though you do have a theme. It's like, man, that's great. Put that on YouTube, because if you're not a journalist that's forced to watch these cards, it's like, you know, if you're not someone who's going out there and you have to do a recap article of the fight after the fight, you are telling the viewer not to watch these live. You know, it's just, it's tough, man, to watch a card that's paced at 30 minutes per bout when only one of those fights is a 25-minute fight. And it's just really a struggle. I mean, the card had so much momentum starting off the broadcast. Like, I loved the Sam Cecilia Derek Campos fight.
Yeah.
But you are right. By the time AJ McKee, Daniel Crawford stepped inside the cage, between the Lara Velasquez fight and the time in between, it was just an absolute, like, it was so cold in there. In terms of watching the broadcast, obviously, not necessarily inside the arena.
Yeah, I mean, there was just things, and I my broadcasting aspect, I look at it and say, man, I wonder how, you know, who came up with this formatted show of just the way it was formatted. I mean, there was just times where I felt like this is nothing but filler content. When we're going to the desk with Jay Glazer, Shel Sonnen, and Josh Thompson, like, I'm sorry, I'm not, you know, no disrespect to those three guys, but I'm not here to sit there and listen to people talk about fights. I'm here to watch fights.
Can we ban the desk from MMA broadcast?
Oh,
we
God, please, please. I sit there, and I just, it was an awful viewing experience. It just was. And, I mean, look, it's, you mentioned Cecilia Campos. That was a great fight. You know, Juliana Vasquez, Alejandro Lara. I believe it was Eric Colon. I don't know what fight he was watching to think that Alejandro Lara won 2 out of 3 rounds. I mean, seriously, like, that's one of those things, like, you know, if I was running the Hawaii Commission, and I know that Mike Mazzulli went out to Hawaii to help them out as well, also taking part of the drug testing, which, by the way, as I reported last week, Mike Mazzulli did drug test Leota Machida out of competition. That drug test did come back clean. But, the Cologne scorecard in that one, I was like, what the hell? What fight were you watching? AJ McKee, you know, another dominating win. I'm sorry. I'm over the AJ McKee 13-1 favorite fights. I'm over it. Like, he needs to be fighting top five guys. And if there's some reason why he's not fighting top five guys, please someone explain it.
Yeah, man. That's my thought process too. I mean, the fight was fine. It was entertaining. It's always entertaining to watch the guy go in there, bring a guy down, lock on a choke, get a tap. But the dude is 13-0. He has wins over John Cesara, win over Justin Lawrence. It feels like a major step backwards after those two fights. And again, I don't think this was like an injury replacement. I think maybe they just wanted AJ McKee on this card. I don't understand. I'm not going to make excuses for it. This fight should have happened because McKee's a star.
It screams of me of we need to keep AJ McKee active and keep him happy. That's what it screams of me. And no disrespect to Ashley Grimshaw, who's going to be facing Emmanuel Sanchez in the main event of Bellator 219 on March 22nd. That should be Emmanuel Sanchez, AJ McKee.
Yeah, no, that's
like I'm to this point with AJ McKee. Like, he is an incredibly talented fighter, but why should I be care? Why should I care about watching AJ McKee fight against Daniel Crawford, who was coming off a loss? Like, you have this incredibly talented fighter, but it's like, I mean, I get the slow build you want to do with fighters, but man, I mean, it's just like, and you mentioned about some of the fights we've seen with AJ McKee. I mean, he was supposed to fight Emmanuel Sanchez a couple years ago, but due to injury, it doesn't happen. I just, you know, when you put these fights against AJ McKee, where he's an 8-1, 9-1, 10-1, 13-1 favorite, those fights just don't interest me.
He literally has the record. He's fought every single fight in his belt in Bellator. Mm-hmm. He has the record for most consecutive wins in the promotion's history. At some point, with 13 straight wins in Bellator, it may be time to stop giving him these fights. You know, Sanchez McKee, I mean, that's a fight that should have happened. That Sanchez Grimshaw main event's a rough
man. All right, by the way, so I'm looking at best fight odds. It says that AJ McKee, the line had got up to a 20-1 favorite.
That's crazy.
That's crazy. Is absolutely nuts. He closed as a 15-1 favorite in this fight. I mean, you look at, he was coming off a win against John Teixeira. Very talented guy. Coming off a win against Justin Lawrence. Very talented guy. But you look at just his overall odds. I mean, if we just take his last five fights, okay? So, Blair Tugman, he was at the absolute best, a 18-1 favorite. Against Brian Moore, a 13-1 favorite. Against Justin Lawrence, nearly a 4-1 favorite. Against AJ, against John Sherrill, which I was amazed by this line, got all the way up to almost an 8-1 favorite. I mean, I'm just, as I said, very talented fighter, but I had no interest in this fight.
Yeah, me neither, man. I absolutely did not. The fight itself, I'll watch it. But again, I think the general takeaway, the general advice is, hey, AJ McKee, let's put him in the cage in an interesting matchup because this is a special talent at 145 pounds, and you're basically wasting his contract before he becomes a free agent and maybe jump ship. As the young 23-year-old, I mean, that's going to be a guy Bellator's going to have to fight to hold on to, because if I am the UFC, AJ McKee is absolutely one of those guys I want to sign. Obviously, one of those guys they couldn't, Michael Chandler, right? Like, I think Michael Chandler in this fight against Brett Primus is just like, geez, this is absolutely maybe the best fighter in Bellator history in terms of, like, homegrown guy.
Here's the thing about Chandler Primus. To me, the stock of Brent Primus went up in this fight. I think it with how that fight played out, if you would have came to us last Wednesday when we did the show and said, this is how the fight's going to play out, we both would have probably said, nah, dog, no. It's not going to play out like that. Like, I would have never thought that Chandler would not want to have a striking matchup with Brent Primus. I understand Michael's wrestling's unbelievable. I get it. But I would have, if you said, where do I think Brent Primus's best chance to win this fight is? It's on the ground using his jiu-jitsu. And it just, it surprised me. And I wonder how much of that really was in the second round when Brent dropped him. And nearly won the fight. I mean,
yeah, he nearly won it with his grappling.
I literally started typing, holy effing, you know, because we know, I would have put as much money as, if you would have told me straight up, just give me a winner, I would have put, I'd made a bet on Michael Chandler. You could have said, you know, let's go $1,000. All right, let's go. I mean, it's just, I just didn't see Brent win that fight. And I look at Michael Chandler and I just, you know, he's been the face of Bellator for a long time. I'm really starting to wonder if Lee McFarlane's going to end up being the face of Bellator in the next year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a great transition because, you know, and you're totally right, Brett Primus. It's ironic. He impressed more in his title loss than his title win against Michael Chandler. The stand-up was great. But, man, Chandler's grappling was just on another level when it comes to positioning, and that helped him win that fight. Was a great fight, but what's that?
But were you like me and like you couldn't believe that he essentially didn't want to strike with Brent?
Well, I was, but Brent's stand-up looked good.
It did. It did.
Like, that's the thing. I don't know if that was his game plan heading into it, or it was audible into the fight.
I remember when I did the interview with Brent, and one of the things, and I thought about it as the fight was going on, and he said, he goes, look, I'm comfortable on my back. I know Chandler's not. And I think that Brent was just too comfortable on his back trying to go for submissions and he, you know, doing whatever he could. I mean, God, I forget who the referee was in that fight. But, I mean, the fact of how many times did Brent get warned about curling his toes in the cage? I mean, it had to be 30 times.
Yeah, that's one of my...
And, like, at what point are you going to just say, I'm going to take a point? Like, yeah. You know, it's just... It just I'm sitting there going, they're never going to take a point from him. So why are you going to stop doing it?
It's such an easy thing to discipline, too. It's not like it's an accident that you go out there trying to do pull-ups with your feet on the cage. I mean, that's gonna be bad one day. Like, somebody's going to pick up a guy while he has his feet wrapped around, and he's going to get his toe amputated like a cheese grater. I mean, that's going to be more rough than watching Frank Mir come out for a second round.
Man, I tell you what, the end of that fight was tough to watch. And I know Frank's podcast partner, Richard Hunter, tweeted on Sunday or Saturday about the injuries and how, you know, Frank lost his mouthpiece and how much pain he was in. That's what caused the tap. But as that fight ended, my initial thought was, I think this is probably the last time we see Frank Mir in MMA competition.
I mean, yes and no. No, because we are fans of MMA, we know what happens. But yes, in terms of what actually transpired, hey, man, it was a fine opening round for Frank Mir. But you're right, that second round, sad is the right word. I mean, anytime you tap out standing, things are rough. I can't even jokingly get excited about Javier Ayala. It was so sad in that second round. But, I mean, that's the recipe that Bellator opens itself up for. It makes sense to sign guys with names that are past their prime because that's what you got to do, I think, in order to get eyeballs on there. People want to see Frank Mir fight again. But the downside is they actually see him fight again, and that's what they got here.
And Frank Mir is now 2-8 in his last 10 fights.
Yeah, it's going to be so difficult for him to get that third win in 11 fights. So I do think we've all but said, and you made the transition earlier, Jason, but you are right. When we talk about like the highlight of the entire weekend, the big highlight, it's so obvious. It's not even the fight, Jason, but the entrance for Lemele McFarlane was absolutely one of my favorite entrances I have seen in a very – I mean, one of the best ever. What just kudos for Bellator to going to Hawaii. After watching that fight, all I can think of is every time Lima fights, I wanted it to be in Hawaii.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things as I was watching that entrance by Lima, the first thought I had really in my head is this is the difference between how Bellator views fighters and how the UFC views fighters, where what we saw with Lima McFarlane, there's no way in hell that would happen in the UFC. No way in hell. Where Bellator, it's about let's let our fighters show who they are. Let them do what they want. Where the UFC would be like, no, you're just walking out. You're not going to have dancers with you, you know. And so that was the first thing. And yeah, I mean, you're right about Lima. I do want to mention one more thing about Michael Chandler before we talk really get into her fight. You got to make Michael Chandler Patricio Pitbull. You have to make that fight.
Absolutely. I think when it comes to what's on my Christmas wish list, Jason, that to me is one of the most compelling 2019 fights Bellator could put on.
If they don't make that fight, that's promotional malpractice.
Absolutely. And I agree with you. I mean, that fight to me is a fight where I think Chandler's going to want to stand and trade just because he's going to want to punch Patricio in the face. But that may not be the best strategy.
And this is one of the things, and to go back, I mean, look, the television ratings weren't great, and the one of the things that, and I tweeted this during the fights on Friday, I do wonder how much pacing of MMA events on cable is why viewership is what it is. I can't help it, but I mean, look, if I'm Bellator, as much as I think potentially Chandler and Patricio could, you know, draw on cable television, I'd make that as a DAZN exclusive fight.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, the one thing is, like, the push-pull is about having your things on DAZN and not on TV. Is it did feel like back in the day you put things on Spike TV and people become stars on Spike. It almost felt like. And the thing is, with the Lemele entrance, my big thought was I almost wish this was on TV because I felt like casual fans watching this, she would have came across like a star and her star power would have risen. So that's the one thing, once you abandon television, you make it harder for people to watch your product. Like you are filtering into the hardcore, and I understand that's how people are consuming media in 2018, 2019, is it's a niche thing. You find your niche. But the one sad part, and I don't know how the combat sports world will reckon with it, is creating those new fans. And it's like that Alima Lay entrance was a moment where I think a lot of new fans could have been created, but I just don't know if that necessarily happened because it was on DAZN.
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at DAZN for Bellator is, you know, for the most part, it's a pay-per-view. I mean, that's essentially what it is. It's a $10 pay-per-view if you want to pay for it. I mean, and you know, Alima gets a submission win, and you know, it'll be interesting to kind of see what they can do to kind of elevate her star power. I mean, I think a lot of that's going to count on them really to, you know, continuing to tell that story of who she is. The surprise of Bellator 213 for me, Liam McGarry knocking out King Mo.
That fight was interesting, man. That fight really was. I couldn't believe that King Mo couldn't wrap things up as soon as he brought Liam McGarry down.
I tell you, and I think a lot of that credit, you know, Liam moved his training to California under Tiki Golston and Paul Herrera, and you really saw those guys, what they were able to do with Liam's takedown offense. I mean, you think about, you know, the fight he had against Phil Davis and other times where he's just been taken down at ease. And to see him, I thought, did a really good job. I mean, you know, King Mo did get the fight to the ground, but I thought Liam did a really great job in that knockout, man. It was just, you know, and then kind of just a weird ending to the fight.
Yeah, man, it really was a weird ending. It was a must-win situation for both guys. It felt like there was a lot on the line, especially if they lost. And for King Mo, I don't even know where you go from here. I mean, obviously we remember Liam. This is guy was a huge light heavyweight prospect, but, man, he really went through a struggle. And that loss to Vadim Nemkov, I thought was – this guy's really on the way downwards, but this was a return – to form. I mean, this was one of the more impressive ones for Liam just because of the quality of opponent and the way things culminated. Again, I think the positive for your fan of Liam McGarry is pretty simple. He got taken down and he didn't quit. He continued to fight. And that led to him taking out one of the better wrestlers we've seen compete at 205 pounds in King Mo. So for King Mo, kind of not at the same point as Frank Mir, but a similar thought process in that I don't necessarily know if he's ever going to compete for a light heavyweight title again after a fight like this.
And speaking of that, he tweeted after a fight, he said, quote, "My money weight days are over. Had to retire that. 185 is my next move. On to the next one." And, you know, obviously I know there was kind of this talk with King Mo of, from a health aspect, was going to 185 what was best for him. So we'll see at 185. Obviously, yeah, Machida gets the win over Rafael Carvalho, a split decision win, and that's clearly going to potentially set up a fight with him and Musasi. Of course, that's saying Musasi gets past Rafael Lovato Jr. in January. Neiman Gracie, Ed Ruth, you know, really enjoyed that those two grapplers going at it. You know, look, I think we both said on this podcast, Ed Ruth was our dark horse in this tournament. Even Scott Coker, you know, came out after a fight and said, you know, hey, you know, Ed Ruth was that guy. But, you know, kudos to Neiman Gracie for getting the win. And now he finds himself, you know, in a title matchup, you know, at some point in 2019. We're going to see when Roy McDonald, John Fitch happens, you know. Scott had mentioned March as a potential date for that one. It should be noted, Scott did mention that their plans are to have this welterweight tournament wrapped up sometime in the fourth quarter of 2019. But, man, huge win for Neiman Gracie. I love the fact that all these fights are five rounds. That fight would have ended after the third round. I think everyone would have said, man, well, I would love to see in the fourth round there. So kudos to him. And Nainoa Dung got the win over Kona Oliveira via TKO. I talked to Nainoa a couple weeks ago, and it should be noted that Bellator has now signed Nainoa to a multi-fight deal for his manager, Jason House. And, you know, I think ultimately, we're going to look back on these two Bellator events a year from now, maybe even 2 years from now, and there might be, maybe it's not Noah Dung, or maybe it's someone else that was on the preliminary cards or either one of these cards, and we'll say, really, the success of that those events in Hawaii for Bellator was they were able to land some local talent that ended up being, you know, fighters that we see on main cards for years to come.
Oh, man, the energy for that. The only fight I saw between local talent against one another was the lightweight bout between Dung and Oliveira. I didn't watch the fights on Bellator, but the energy in the building was great. And it is, you know, it is a scene that we have been aware of since the BJ Penn days. And we've seen plenty of examples of guys, including the featherweight champion, Max Holloway. So Hawaii is just a phenomenal state. It was a great time this weekend to sit back and watch Bellator take a trip in Hawaii. And I mean, it's kind of why we're leading the show off with this instead of the UFC. It just felt like it was a Bellator weekend, I thought. But yeah, Dung looked great. I mean, that fight between him and Oliveira, I really, really enjoyed. It was a great start to the card. The local aspect's a huge part. I mean, when I look at my big takeaways, I mean, that's one of them. The other one I think is Neiman Gracie. Yeah. That was the big takeaway. Like, I did not think he was going to beat Ed Ruth. I knew it was going to be a great fight, and I knew the fact of the matter is that Ed Ruth, his skill set lent itself to lose to a guy like Neiman Gracie. I mean, look, at the end of the day, we know what Gracie's good at. It's not hidden. You know, it's in his last name. But we knew he was a good grappler. When you maybe gets taken down, he's going to have jiu-jitsu. But the two things about Neiman in this fight is his stand-up looked good, like really solid. And I'm like, man, this guy's going to be a long-term player at welterweight watching this fight. And also, the wrestling of Neiman Gracie was pretty good against Ed Ruth. That really impressed me. And a great fourth-round win. So, I mean, I think the three big takeaways was like Bellator in Hawaii, massive success. Neiman Gracie, I mean, he's not a guy I'm going to pick against Rory McDonald, but that's more about what I think of McDonald than Gracie. His stock rose beating Ed Ruth. And then obviously number three, Jason, is one of the biggest stars is Lemele McFarlane. Valle Letourneau gave a good fight, especially in that first round, that second round. But I'm so glad, not to be biased against Valerie, but I really wanted that crowd to be rewarded with a finish. And they got it, man. I mean, the energy – It's unlike anything we have seen in the history of Bellator, that crowd energy for that main event.
Yeah, MMA Fighting had a great video. I want to say they put on their Twitter account from the crowd of when Alima won that fight. It was just an amazing scene. But also on Saturday night, we had UFC on Fox 31. Ally Quinta gets a decision win over Kevin Lee. Edson Barboza, that knockout win against Dan Hooker. Rob Font gets a win against Sergio Pettis. Charles Oliveira doing what he does, gets submission win against Jim Miller. You know, some notable match things to mention from the preliminary card. You got to mention Joaquin Sylvia, that knockout against Jared Gordon. Poor Jared Gordon's going to see that knockout for the rest of his career. That's going to be on the UFC highlight reels. Dan Ige, Jordan Griffin, that was a really good fight. Mike Rodriguez, the knockout win. Also Juan Adams gets a TKO win against Chris De La Rocha. I want to start off let's start off with the co-main event. Were you like me going back and watching this fight and you just really had a lot of questions about what Dan Hooker's corner was thinking after the second round?
Oh yeah. Oh, I think anyone who watches this fight couldn't believe it. This guy should not have been out there. I mean, there was so much damage to Dan Hooker in so many different places, but I think it starts with the mobility of him against a guy like Edson Barboza. This fight was fun. It's always cool to watch Barboza dissect another human being, but it's also dark. And this was absolutely a time where you just put another notch down. We have another questionable corner. And I understand it's the heat of the moment, but God, watching it was like, how do you not throw in the towel for your poor fighter?
Yeah, that's the whole thing. And I had someone text me on Sunday while I was working the game, asked me about it. And at that point, I had just seen the highlights. I hadn't seen the fight. And I said, I texted him. I said, it's as I always say, if the announcers are yelling to stop the fight, that's not a good look. And I mean, it's one of these things of a you know, and Rob Hines. I've got a lot of respect for Rob Hines, but you got to look at him of why when you look at the way Dan Hooker just hands down, just really wasn't defending himself. Of you know, your job is to be to protect the fighters, but then there's just these points of like I'm thinking, come on, Dan Hooker's corner, throw in the goddamn towel. Show your compassion for your fighter. I mean, I know it's easy for us to Monday morning quarterback this. I do wonder how much of the fact that your pay goes up 50% if you win the fight lays into why a corner A doesn't stop the fight between rounds and B doesn't throw in the towel during the round.
That's a tough one, man. I feel like that plays a role, but to be, you know, I'm a cynical guy, and I think you're probably right. But I think the less cynical answer for why we don't see this happen, Jason, is like, if it's not the pay, it's the fact that you get so, like, infatuated with your fighter. You envision him winning. You envision him having rocky moments. You can't fathom your friend in the gym. You can't fathom him losing. And I think emotionally, to take that away from a guy, I think that's rough. But with all that being said, as hard as that is, when you're in the corner, you need to understand it is your responsibility to remove your fighter from the fight when things are done and he's just getting hurt. So it's tough, but it's a decision that should have been made.
After a second round, he's just sitting on the mat. Like, no one apparently brings a stool in, which please explain this one to me. and you got the doctors asking him where are you at, what year is it, all this, and I'm just sitting there going, man. And I mean, and then when Cormier is yelling, stop the fight, Anik goes, the corner could throw in the towel too. I'm like, oh John, I love it. I mean, I'm just like, oh man, it was tough to watch Dan Hooker go out there and just, I mean, get battered. And it's one of those things of I wish MMA was like other sports. Like, if your favorite football team, the coach makes a questionable decision, well, after the game's over, the media can ask him, hey coach, it was third and five from the opponent's 45-yard line, why'd you make the call you made there? And it's like, you wish that after the fight was over, the reporters could go to Dan Hooker's corner and go, hey guys, can you kind of tell us what was your mindset after a second round with your fighter, why you sent him out there, and was there ever any consideration of throwing the towel in the third round?
Yeah, and like a struggling fan base, I mean, Dan Hooker may need to look into firing them, or not necessarily firing them, but removing them from that specific position, because God, they failed it. I mean, yeah, keep them in the gym, train with them, let them be your coaches and whatnot, but don't let them be the cornerman anymore. I think you failed the test, right? Like there are only so many times in your life you're going to be put in that position, whether you succeed or fail, in keeping your fighter from receiving more damage when the fight's over and he can't move. And they failed it. They absolutely did. And again, this is obviously a dangerous sport, but it doesn't need to be this way. And that, to me, was the big takeaway of that fight. And it's a shame because it's like Edson Barboza looked great. I mean, he looked phenomenal. Yeah. And it was just like he was facing a guy that was trying to climb up the mountain and use him to climb up higher, to put his foot on his head and shove him down. And, God, he shut him out with his leg kicks in this fight.
I know. It was crazy. I mean, look, sign me up for Edson Barboza, Ally Quinta.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. How did you score the main event?
I had it 48-47 for Al.
You have? I had the same thing. I had rounds 1, 4, and 5 for Al, mm-hmm. the second and third for Kevin Lee. Now, the 49-46 card, I can't really defend it. I don't think it's a completely awful card. I can see maybe if you scored, the second round for Al. But, man, Kevin Lee's reaction to this, like, it made me wonder, was his corner honest with him between rounds of, especially after round one and after round four of, did they tell him he won those rounds?
I don't know. I hate it when corners do it though. But yeah, I mean, this was not a fight in which if you're, I mean, this was absolutely not a robbery. I mean, Ali Aquinta won this fight in my scorecard, and I don't know how you can tell me he won the round after the fourth round, Jason. I mean, God. But yeah, it was 1-4-5. I mean, to me, like the story of this fight was pretty awesome for Aquinta. It felt like Kevin Lee never hit the NOS button if this was a street race. He never went all the way there. I mean, he obviously had a great portion in 2 and 3. I mean, the wrestling was fine and it allowed him to win rounds and do damage. It's just like he faded towards the end, and Ali Aquinta really stepped things up. And, you know, he was a sizable underdog against Kevin Lee. And he kind of showed why that may have been a mistake and why he's a top lightweight with the way he performed in rounds 4 and 5. The stand-up looked sharp and crisp. And it was more about the gas tank of Aquinta compared to Kevin Lee. It's just he kept the pressure going after having rounds in which he lost. So, you know, if you're Kevin Lee and you think he won that fight, you're going to have to rewatch that one because Ali Aquinta absolutely won that 3-2.
Yeah,
4-1, I wouldn't agree, but 3-2, yes.
It's, and I mean, look, if you're on the Kevin Lee, this, if you think he won the fight 48-47, I mean, to me, really, and even Cormier mentioned this on the broadcast, it came down to the fifth round. I think, you know, it was tied going that fifth round, and what I think put Al over the was really those last 90 seconds of the first round or the final round. He was just going for it, and Kevin Lee, I mean, was taking some shots, and you know, obviously, you know, to me, Kevin Lee, he goes in that list of guys that would make a 165-pound weight class great, because clearly he has cut so much to get down to 155. But we'll see what happens there. Rob Font gets a win. You know, in terms of the prelims, I kind of mentioned some of the kind of my overall you know, thoughts of it. You know, poor Jerry Gordon, man. He's going to see that knockout forever.
Oh yeah, that was a great fight though. So at least he's going to get the $50,000 bonus. Rarely do we see fights on the prelims get it anymore. I mean, just stuff that you didn't mention. I guess the only thing would be, I guess two things would be, Jack Hermanson's victory over Gerald Meerschaert was dominant. I mean, he just outclassed Gerald in getting that submission victory. So big win for the middleweight there. And then the other thing would be, I guess you mentioned this one, but God, Sergio Pettis, he better hope that a flyweight division comes back. Don't get me wrong, when you move up to 135, there is no tougher size task than taking on a lengthy Rob Font, but geez, that jab just, he couldn't do anything in that fight. And then also the other one, Oliveira just completely runs through Jim Miller. Great performance, but geez, Charles, don't sour me on your fight by afterwards telling me about how you're going to go down to featherweight. You can't do it. Okay.
No. He does not need to go to featherweight. He needs to stay at 155. I'll tell you, I got an interesting question. I got to find it on my social media here, but it was about Jim Miller and the UFC Hall of Fame. And I want to see if your response is kind of the same way I respond to this. And this came from at Parcells123. Goes, do you put Jim Miller in the Hall of Fame over the following? Rogério Nogueira, Tim Sylvia, Josh Koscheck, Kenny Florin, Sean Sherk, Gray Maynard, Nate Marquardt. Now, my response to was this. For me, a Sports Hall of Fame is the best of the best. And in terms of the UFC Hall of Fame, my personal criteria is you had to win a UFC title. Which, AK, I mean, look, longevity doesn't make you a Hall of Famer. I mean, Jim Miller, incredibly talented fighter, but I don't think Hall of Fame.
It's tough. It depends on – it's tough. I don't think Hall of Fame either. He reminds me of like a baseball player that had a lot of at-bats and just racked up counting stats. But it's not even like Jim Miller is absolutely an important part of the UFC that should be remembered, but the Hall of Fame isn't that – or my ideal Hall of Fame isn't that, I guess. The UFC Hall of Fame might be that. It might be a nice little ceremony where you remember a few guys every year. And maybe you throw Jim Miller in there.
Here's the question. What's the most notable win on Jim Miller's career?
God, it's
looking at it right now. Okay, do we look at Charles Oliveira from 2010, UFC 124, Joe Lazone, UFC 155?
I think the Matt Wyman win at Fight for the Troops. When it comes to, I mean, that was a good.
He was always that guy that got to a certain point and could never take the next step.
Yeah, and the guys.
To me, that's not Hall of Fame. Like, it's got to be, you got to, you know. I mean, you know, but that's just me. That's my criteria for Hall of Fame is you got to be the absolute best of the best. And at Jim Miller's highest peak, top five, top six.
Yeah, even if this guy, you know, holds records, he has the most UFC fights. He has the most wins in the promotion's history, but the quality wins just aren't there. And I disagree with the caveat that every guy has to win a title to be in the Hall of Fame. I think there's going to be some examples of guys. Like Donald Cerrone, to me, is a Hall of Famer, and he hasn't won a title.
He's at least fought for a title, though.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. And,
Jim Miller's never fought for the UFC title.
Yeah, yeah, but he's worth being remembered, but you know, he's not a guy I would put in the Hall of Fame. I wouldn't even put guys like Sean Sherk or Nate Marquardt in the UFC Hall of Fame. So, all right, let's see. What was that list again? Do you have it, or did you lose it?
No, I got it.
I mean, to me, was it Rogério Nogueira?
Rogério Nogueira.
Oh, no, I wouldn't put him either.
Tim Sylvia
might be the one guy. He might be the one I would put in there.
Josh Koscheck, I mean.
No.
No. Kenny Florian, no. Gray Maynard, no. Nate Marquardt, no. I mean, these are all, like, I get the list of why you put all these fighters in this list. But to me, like, you know, you got to look at it and say, I think, you know, and you can look at any Hall of Famer in this class is when they were playing, were they at the elite of their position? And
Tim Sylvia was, I think. He's the one I would look at.
Yeah, man. It's to me. I mean, outside of longevity and the amount of wins Jim Miller has in the UFC, which obviously has to do with, you know, amount of times in the UFC. It's a tough case to say he's a Hall of Famer.
Absolutely, second to Jason.
So, but yeah. So yeah, we got the rare weekend of no UFC. But we do have a UFC 232 next week. Of course, we'll have a preview show for that next week, so look out for that. But right now, we're going to get into the interview portion of the show. Up first, you're going to hear my conversation with Zach Otto as he recaps his win over Dwight Grant. In the interview, he talks about how pretty much he felt that if he didn't get the win, he was going to get cut by the UFC. Then you hear my conversation with Mike Rodriguez as he talks about the combination he threw was actually something they put in the day of the fight. Then you hear my conversation with Walt Harris, and then you hear my conversation with Travis Davis. Last week on the program, we were joined by Zach Otto, and he is back on this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast. We talk about his victory at UFC on Fox 31, split decision win over Dwight Grant. Zach Otto, Zach, I appreciate time. Before we get to the fight, man, how would you kind of fighting in Milwaukee? Obviously, you got a great ovation as Bruce Buffer's announcing your name. What was last week like for you fighting in Milwaukee?
Really great. You know, it just went really smooth. No time change to deal with. Got to sleep in my own bed all week. I just stayed at the hotel one night, the night to cut weight, because you know we have the early weigh-ins on Friday. So besides that, it was just pretty normal routine during the week. You know, gym ran real smooth with the whole coaching staff being there. I didn't take them away somewhere, some other country or anything like that. So you know, I obviously didn't teach or anything like that, but. It was just real, real natural, real normal all around, you know, my normal surroundings and stuff. Had some stuff to do a little bit here and there, obviously with the UFC during the week, but, I love it. I wish every fight could be like that, but.
Some fighters who have been in your position will say, you know what, I'm staying at the hotel all week. It's just part of fight camp. This is what you do. Was that ever in consideration?
No, you know, and this was a short fight camp, so I just wanted to keep things as normal as possible. Nothing like sleeping in your own bed, at least for me. You know, if I don't feel absolutely comfortable, I'm not getting that good sleep and stuff like that, sleeping in some hotel bed that you're just not used to. So I like to keep it as normal routine as possible. Our hard day at the gym is on Saturdays, our Saturday sparring days and stuff like that. So it just all week felt very natural.
as somebody like myself that does travel for a living, particularly this time of year, I can relate how you talk about that bed. Sometimes you get in that hotel bed, you're like, oh man, I'm not going to wake up good tomorrow. And obviously for you, competing, there's been times I wake up in the morning and make, man, back hurts a little bit. I can't imagine being a fighter. You wake up on a Saturday morning and your back's a little stiff.
Yeah, and especially for me, I don't know if it's getting in my older age and stuff, but my back's got to be comfortable. And then I'm also real sensitive to light when I sleep. And at home, I have blackout shades. And sometimes you'll get that in hotels. You can black it out pretty good. But I like my own little environment at my house. So it was nice keeping it all like that during the week.
When we spoke a couple of weeks ago leading up to this fight, I thought the thing that really stuck out to me, you said, I feel like this is kind of like a regional level fight because of the lack of footage there was out there on Dwight. As the fight started and you get into second round, third round, was there some surprises that you just didn't expect to see from him?
I watch a lot of tape from the coaching standpoint as well. And, that all helps. The little bit of tape that I did have, it really was a good representation of what I thought I was going to deal with and what I did end up dealing with. His wall work was pretty good. Anytime we were clinched up against the fence, he was strong and knew what he was doing in the clinch. He was strong and knew what he was doing on his back. Most of the fight did take place on the feet, and he was pretty much what I expected. Very rangy counter striker with a ton of power. And, I had to really control what was going on a lot with my footwork and take some of his tools away from him. And I was also bringing that left high kick a lot of times, not necessarily to actually land, but just to keep that right hand home. If you look statistically on how many times he counters with his right hand against other people and how many times he did it against me, it was far less volume coming with that right hand against me than other people. So I felt like I did a good job playing that chess match a little bit and controlling his tools a little bit. But of course, that's not always what the fans want to see. So they want to see two people, meet in the center and throw down and have one of them fall. Unfortunately, nothing like that happened. But I had to be smart. I had to get this win and was able to get that done.
Yeah, that was one of the things. I didn't watch this fight live. I watched it after the fact. And one of the things that really stuck out to me about it is I was like, man, he's constantly throwing that high kick. And it wasn't, I never felt like, oh, it's that strike-ending blow, but it was like something you kept throwing out there, going out there. So definitely something I noticed.
A lot of times I was even using it as a rhythm reset. Sometimes on tape and what I could feel in the fight was he gets into like a little rhythm kind of moving to his right. And then he's just looking to bomb that right hand over the top and follow it up with the left. And a lot of times, right when it started to feel like he was getting comfortable and into a rhythm, I would just throw it up there just to break up the rhythm, just to keep that right hand home, make him have to kind of reset and get back into a groove of, feeling when the right time to counter strike was. So not always to land, but it did open up, throwing a lot of those high kicks, it did open up. I did land one, I wish more, really good kicks to the body then, because then he saw that same kick kind of starting to come. He was getting those hands up really high elbow, and he left his body open on one of them, and I was able to rip a good kick to the body on one of those shots. I forget if it was late in the second round or something like that, but could have done more with that.
One of the things I also noticed watching the fight, I want to say it was in the second round, threw a little spinning back fist. It didn't land, but that was that something you were working on that you like you thought that it would be there in the fight?
Not necessarily this fight. I throw a lot of spinning techniques in practice, but sometimes you can't force things in a fight. You kind of got to go with what the person's giving you, and I'd have to watch it back and know with what I was seeing at that particular time, but. In practice, I throw a ton of spinning techniques.
Now, when...
One spinning back kick against Mike Pyle. I don't know. Well, maybe we'll see more of that stuff in the future. But like I said, the person's got to be giving you the right feedback. And it's hard when that person, it's like Anderson Silva. You know, if you want to come at Anderson Silva, he's a spectacular finisher, right? But if you play that counter in the counter game with Anderson Silva, we all know he's had those fights that have had, you know, really low volume and kind of a more boring fight or whatever you want to say. But it, you got to be smart against those guys. Otherwise, you're going to get torched, you know. So I had to do what I had to do. You can't pick these opponents. They're, all these guys are the best in the world. I'm trying to get a win here to keep my fucking job, you know. So,
I mean, did you – you've now mentioned this twice. So I got to ask the question. Did you feel like if you lost this fight, you might have been released from your contract?
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting towards the end of this contract, and I don't know, with the new ownership, they seem to be cutting ties with people sooner than maybe a couple years ago. Especially when you start to make a little bit more money after a couple wins. You know, if you're not from the business side, if you're not getting that return on investment with them, you know, they'll let you go. So I got to get here. I got one more fight left on my contract. I think I really need to go in there and perform well. Now that I've got this win, I feel like I can get back to maybe pushing a more aggressive type pace. And, you know, we'll see what the next matchup is. Hopefully it's Alex Morono. And a guy like that I can get a finish on and then go into my third contract with some more negotiating power.
Alex Morono, I feel like that name has come up in our conversations countless times. It just has never come together.
Exactly. Let's do this. I mean, all the way from the regional level. Let's go. We've been all crossed ties, you know, cross paths a million times. And he's coming off of a win, just fought in late November. I'm coming off of a win. We both have 4 wins and 7 UFC fights. You know, both BJJ black belts that own our own schools and stuff. I mean, there's so many similarities on paper. We're both calling each other out. I don't know why we can't just make this fight happen.
Come on, Sean Shelby, make the fight happen. It's a fight that both sides want.
Yeah.
I got to ask you, though, final buzzer sounds. Are you confident that the scores are going your way?
Not on this one, to be honest. Berkman and Kunimoto, as soon as the scorecards start to get read off, you know it's going to be a split the way it's read. And against Berkman and Kunimoto, I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Like, this is some bullshit. And then you look afterwards at MMADecisions.com and every single media outlet has me winning the fight. It's like, what the hell were you watching? You know? But Sergio, I felt, was a toss-up. And being in Brazil, and, you know, just didn't go my way. All right, not upset about it. Should have done more to secure the win. This one I felt was like a toss-up too. And this one went my way. So thanks, you know, grateful for that. I'm going to come back and I'm going to be much better in the future and make sure I secure these wins and get some more finishes. He is a tough dude. I expect him to definitely get some wins in the UFC here going forward. He's not going to be one of these guys that has a couple and he's gone. He's going to be around the UFC for a while. Yeah, the first round I felt like was a toss-up. Looking back on it, you know, of course my coaches are going to tell me we're down, we got to do more if it's close at all, because you can't just, oh, let's just keep the fight going the way it's going and then you lose the decision. You know, we got to stomp the gas pedal here. Let's not just get the takedown. Let's get the takedown. Let's pass the guard. Let's finish, right? Like, let's keep push. You know, when the final bell rings, you should have nothing left in the gas tank, you know, lay it all out there. First round, I felt like could have went either way. Second round, I felt he had it. And third round, I felt I had it. So it all, I think, kind of came down to how you saw that first round. I had way more octagon control and I was putting out more volume. He had like one exchange where he landed something. Other than that, like, I mean, he wasn't giving me anything. He wasn't putting out any volume.
There's sometimes, and this is just a general thing in MMA judging, that you sit there, you watch a fight and it's a split decision. I mean, on the Bellator card on Friday night, the woman's fight, it was a split decision. And you're sitting there going, what fight was he watching? Because it was a clear winner. I mean, and I have to imagine as a fighter, whether we're talking about your fights or maybe, you know, one of your students that you're in the corner of, that's gotta be one of the most frustrating things where the score doesn't go your way and you're just kind of like, what fight were they watching?
Yeah. I've been around that from coaching. And like I said, you know, with those first two wins I had in the UFC, but this one wasn't like that. As I lined up to get the scorecards read off, I was prepared for one way or another, but thankfully it went my way.
So I got to imagine you're in Vegas next weekend with Montel. Are you going to be nudging Sean Shelby? Like, hey, he wants to fight. I want the fight. Let's make this thing happen.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, that's my plan. You know, obviously just kind of getting settled in here, after this win, I'm going to just kind of enjoy the holidays and stuff. And then, yeah, it's time to start pushing for this, even more so than I have been. Hopefully Alex is open to it still and we make this happen. You know, I do have a manager and he knows I've been harping him and riding him about this for a while too. So we all know what the deal is. We'll make it happen, I feel.
And we're just going to have to wait and see when that fight could potentially take place, even though it seems like we've talked about it forever. Zach, man, as always, I appreciate the time. Of course, let everyone know and they can follow you on social media and the sponsors that help support you.
Yeah, please follow me on social media, on Instagram, Zach Otto. I'm also on Facebook there. And then on Twitter, the handle @TheBarbarianMMA. And, yeah, just want to throw a shout-out to my team. We've really been capitalizing on these opportunities lately, and we got Montel Jackson fighting here on the last card of the year. So please tune in and watch Montel Jackson get a nasty finish inside the octagon.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a man who scored a victory this past weekend, UFC on Fox 31. It's Mike Rodriguez, got the knockout win over Adam Milstead. Mike, as always, man, I appreciate time. Do you kind of feel like a little burden's been lifted off your shoulders following this victory?
Yeah, I do. I feel like I like being back in the winning column.
I mean, I know you talked about it after the fight, about kind of that pressure, you know, after you lost, you know, earlier this year. I mean, it is like throughout camp, was it just something weighing on you? Like, was it a mental thing for you?
At first it was, I was too busy. I was stressing myself out about winning. And then, I read a quote from, John Wooden, the UCLA coach, John Wooden. And he was saying that, the whole thing was that he was saying that it's all about execution. Like, don't worry about the win. Like, he always tried to emphasize that on his players. So I took a lot of his philosophy and I put it into training. And I've been crushing it leading up to that fight. And everything just panned out.
Obviously, since you were the second fight of the night, there was a lot of sitting around to see if you maybe were going to walk away with a performance of the night bonus. Yeah. You know, did we come a point in the night you're like, I don't think this is going to happen?
Yeah, when I saw the... what was the one when the guy knocked him out in a cage?
That would have been Joaquin Silva.
Yeah, Jared Gooden. Fight. I was like, jeez.
And he still didn't
really
get it.
Back and forth. Yeah. That was insane.
Dude, oof.
It was crazy. And everybody kept like asking me like, oh, you think you're still in the running? You're still in the running? And I'm like, I don't know, man. That fight was really good. And then Barbosa came out and crushed it. And I was like, oh. But yeah, shout out to those guys. Those guys did good. But yeah, it was. I was more nervous for that than I was the fight, honestly.
I mean, in terms of the fight, you mentioned after the fight, said, you know, thing y'all had noticed was he's a guy who doesn't really move a lot. He comes at you, but was there anything that surprised you, maybe of how he tried to attack you?
No, I knew. Legit everything how he was going to come out. I knew he was going to come out, that he likes a firefight. And I kind of got into a firefight with him in a little bit. We got into a little brawl. And then I had to back up and reassess the situation. And I'm like, that's not your game. You don't play that game. And so, you know, but yeah, he Yeah, I knew he came out exactly the way we planned on him coming out. He came out exactly like that.
I had talked to him prior to the fight, and it was right after the Thiago Santos-Jimmy Manuel fight. I said, hey, is this what this is going to be, version 2.0? You know, he kind of alluded to it. It's like, look, this is kind of what I do. You know, I go out there, I'm looking for exciting fights. And he didn't mention, he said, look, I love this fight because I know Mike's going to – he's going to stand there with me. He's not going to try to sit there, shoot for a takedown. He's going to stand with me. That brawl you mentioned, right, it was like first 30 seconds of the fight, y'all two started going at it. Was there something during the camp where your team's like, look, we can't get in a brawl. We got to be technical here. Where was that in your mindset of when that was going down?
Yeah, exactly how it was. So we knew how he likes to be in exciting fights and get into brawls. So we just was like, that's not how we're going to play this. We're just going to pick him apart from the outside and everything. And that's what happened. All the best strikes in the whole fight were all from me being on the outskirts, picking them apart.
And, of course, you get the win here. You mentioned no injuries, ready to get back in there. You mentioned maybe even the Arizona car because of your living in Tucson in the past. I mean, do you think that's a good opportunity for you?
Yeah, man, I really hope so. I would like to get on that card. I don't want to be on the shelf for a long time. Like 2 or 3 months is good, but I want to get back in there.
I know you mentioned you gave up video games, during this camp. I mean, you got home on Sunday. Was that kind of the first thing you turned on?
That's exactly the first thing I did on Sunday. As soon as I got home, I played a bunch of games and then I slept all day.
So what's the go-to game right now for you?
Right now I was playing Rainbow Six, but I'm about to start up that Red Dead. Since everybody keep telling me to play it, it's like, you have to play it.
But I mean, obviously, I got to imagine you're already back in the training room.
No, not yet. I usually like take a week off and then after a fight, because just like all the bumps and bruises from the fight and the training camp and everything, I just want to chill. But I will be back next week.
I mean, have you even thought about like, you know what, I would like this fight or that fight? I mean, has that even come across your mind?
No, I not yet. Not at all. It haven't. Right now, I feel like I'm not really in the spotlight or in this place to be calling guys out and everything. You know what I mean? So I'm like, I'm just waiting till when I get into the numbers, get a number near my name, then I could stop being like, oh, I want that guy, this guy, that guy, or whatever.
In terms of the fight, we always talk about grading your performance. I mean, I don't know if that's something you do or your coaches do, but if you had to grade your performance, what would it be?
I would say that was an A+. That was really good. I was actually impressed with myself. I think what I was more impressed was the combination I hit him with. We plugged that in the night before. Yeah, so we knew we had. So usually we get like a workout session in the morning before fight day, just to make sure our first sweat isn't in the back. Make sure it's the first sweat of the day. So I'm like, all right, we can't do that because our will call was so early. So we're like, all right, let's get a workout at night. And I was practicing that, but it was just something I thought was ready to be brought into the test. So I'm like, oh, you know, I've been practicing it, and then. Everybody was like, all the coaches were like, hit that shit tomorrow. If you get him lined up near the fence, hit that tomorrow. I hit it, and it landed flush. It was awesome.
Now, when you look back at all of your wins throughout your career, how many times have you sat there and said, I was impressed with myself?
A bunch of times. Prior to this fight, my most impressive win, what I personally thought it was the one against Alec Hubin. I just thought that was a really good win for me, just of how the fight turned out. But I would say this probably was like second, or maybe, second. I still like the Hubin win a lot. It just felt good to get that win.
Now, one of the things, and I guess I've never thought of you having a nickname. And I didn't realize this until I was, looking at your record of the nickname Slow.
Yeah.
Where? Okay. I've never heard anybody. I don't know. Maybe I just haven't noticed people call you this nickname. But what is the origin of this?
So when I first got to Lozon's, I hit some boxing mitts with my boxing coach Steve Mays. I never did any sort of boxing mitts before, and he said, "Jesus Christ, you are fucking slow." And before everybody used to call me Big Mike, and then they're like, no, we're gonna have to call you Slow Mike, and they just was calling me Slow Mike ever since then. And then the name kind of like faded out, and then it came back, and then it faded out again. But they called me Slow Mike for a while.
I mean, I gotta imagine you hate that nickname.
It's a nickname, unfortunately. It's like they're just given. Like, you can't give yourself a nickname, so it's like, whatever.
Did you have a nickname, like, growing up just around your boys?
Around boys. It's always, well, like, home, it's always Mickey.
Okay.
Like, everybody always called me Mickey. So everybody would either call me Mick or Mickey. But other than that, like, that was it.
The slow nickname, man. I'm telling you, that one caught me off guard. I was like,
yeah, it catches a lot of people off guard.
I would never expect a fighter to, in first off, be cool with that being thrown out there as your nickname.
Yeah, I'm just like, whatever about it. But what could you do?
So now a couple days have gone by. I mean, are you still kind of in that celebration mode?
Yeah, man. I'm just kicking it, chilling with the kids, playing some games. That's pretty much it. And like just seeing the highlight being posted everywhere. It's like getting reposted all the time, people tagging me and stuff like that. And other than that, it's pretty cool.
And of course we all look forward to seeing when that next fight may take place. Maybe it is in Phoenix there in February, the ESPN debut for a big ESPN debut for the UFC. Mike, man, as always, I appreciate time. Let everyone know they can follow you out on social media. If there's any sponsors that help support you during this camp that you want to shout out.
You can follow me at Mrod MMA on Instagram and on Twitter. Mike Rodriguez on Facebook. I want to give a huge shout out to Heap for taking care of me throughout this camp. They provided me with a couple of things that I really needed. Thank you. Love you for that. And last but not least, huge shout out to the babysitters. The babysitters. If it wasn't for them, man, huge shout out to them. Just for them, like, making things work. They're changing our schedules, their own personal life schedules, to plug me in, to help me out. Thank you for that. Love you guys for that one.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report, a man's going to be a part of UFC 232, the end-of-the-year pay-per-view. Big ticket, Walt Harris. Walt, man, as always, I appreciate the time. Another matchup here on, potentially the biggest, one of the biggest fight cards of the year. Andrei Arlovsky is the opponent. Do you remember the first time you saw an Andrei Arlovsky fight?
Man, oh, God, it was a long, long time ago. He had the big beard. I'm trying to think of who he fought. Maybe it was Cabbage Correa. And I was just like, damn, this dude's a beast. You know what I mean? Like, he was amazing, you know. That was, like, well before I was even fighting. So it was pretty cool to get a matchup with him, you know, being that I followed his career.
You know, obviously you've now been doing this for some time. Pro debut back in May of 2011, an 18-second TKO. What do you remember about your pro debut? Is there something that sticks out to you?
Yeah, man, I was scared to death. I remember I was just scared, man. I was like, why am I doing this? You know, like what possessed me to want to do this? But it ended up working out in my favor, and the rest is history, man.
You know, I've talked to football players who've made that transition. Eric Anders, a guy that obviously you're very familiar with, about the traits that you bring from the football field to the MMA cage. Being a college basketball player, what do you think is the biggest trait that you were able to bring from the basketball court to the MMA cage?
Sweet feet, man. The agility, the speed, and the footwork. I think that translated perfectly from basketball over to MMA, for me at least. you know, it just helped me pick up the footwork and striking and boxing and different things like that at a faster rate. And, you know, just the anaerobic part of it, the sprint, the quick burst, you know, that all played a factor in fighting. So I think it helped me out tremendously for sure.
Do you ever get a phone call from one of your former teammates that just they learn that all of a sudden you're an MMA fighter and they just can't believe it?
Yeah, it's like all the time, man. Everybody I talk to, they're like, yo, what? Like, because I was voted like class clown in high school. So, like, you know, like nobody would have predicted, you know, 12, 15 years later, I'm fighting in the UFC. So it's just one of those things, man, that just kind of I gravitated to. And anything I do, I try to do the best of my ability. So it kind of landed me in the UFC as a blessing, you know, to be a part of it. And, you know, we'll keep pushing, see where it goes.
When you were in high school, was there a dream job?
Yeah, man, of course. The first dream job was NBA, and the second was to be a lawyer. And I just got to the point, the NBA dream was very close to coming true. I just hit a snag toward the end, you know, and I just kind of got to a point where I just gave up on athletics because it was tough, man. It was like doing something your whole life and then it kind of just not being able to do it anymore. It was tough. And I kind of had my kid, I had my son, and it was just, you know, 2 years of doing nothing, man, just hanging out, gained a bunch of weight. And then I kind of found MMA and the rest is history, man.
And for a lot of MMA fans, the introduction to yourself was 2013 when you made that UFC debut. What would you say is the differences between yourself now and then as opposed to kind of how you looked at the game?
Oh, man. I mean, me then, I was one dimensional. I was a striker and that was it. Now I think I'm a complete fighter. I can grapple. I can wrestle. I have submissions. Unfortunately, you don't get to see a lot of those in fights because the fights end faster. But I do practice and work on those skills a lot. I spend a lot of time wrestling and doing things that I know my opponents are going to try to exploit. You know, in my view of the game, it's a fight. You know, when I first came to UFC, it was just everything was magnified, man. It was just like, wow, you know, you see cameras, you seeing all these guys that you watched and saw on TV. It was just like, holy crap, like, this is real. Now it's like, I'm one of those guys, you know what I mean? It's like, I know all the guys. I know everybody in the company. I'm like, hey, man, hey, I'm back. Hey, how y'all doing? You know, we laugh, we joke, we cut up. And a lot of these people I keep in contact with when I'm not fighting. So it's just like, you know, we pick up where we left off and it's my job. You know, now it's not so much of a moment. It's more about going in and doing what I need to do.
In terms of Arlovsky, what do you think are the big similarities and differences between your game and his game?
Similarities, I mean, we like to strike. You know, we like to stand and bang. The differences is I think I'm way more athletic. I think I'm way faster. And I think I have more tools to bring to the fight than, you know, I think he's at a point now in his career where, you know, he hasn't evolved much. He's still kind of the same guy, you know, but I'm evolving constantly. And I think that's the difference. And that's what's going to win me the fight.
I'm sure you've probably watched this fight against Tuivasa, you know, from earlier this year. I mean, was there anything that stuck out to you about how he fought that fight?
No, I mean, I don't know, man. I just saw the same guy, you know. I didn't see nothing really stuck out or impressed me about the fight at all, honestly. You know, like I said, I think I present a challenge to guys in the division that you can't mimic me. You can't find a guy in the gym that can mimic me. So, sorry, my Charles Russell was just calling me. I don't think you can mimic me in the gym. You can try, but once you get in the cage with me, you realize, damn, this dude's big and fast and athletic. Like, he's not standing still. He's not just a big heavyweight that lumbers forward. He does things like a smaller guy, a guy twice, you know, as small as him. So, you know, I don't think he's going to be able to deal with what I'm bringing to the table, honestly.
Yeah, and of course, you're coming off that win earlier this year against Daniel Spitz. I mean, as you think, I mean, you've been in the UFC now for a long time. I mean, where do you, in terms of where you believe, you know, kind of where you can go? I mean, if you know, 10 is, you know, top of the line, you know, and we're talking about a scale of 1 to 5, where do you think you are kind of in showing your full potential as a mixed martial artist?
I don't think I've even scratched the surface, and that's the scary part. I think I have so much more to offer to the fans. You know, like, I think they see me and they see my fights and they're like, okay, this guy's got like 12 finishes, all KOs. Like, people aren't making it out of the first round. And they don't realize that I have grappling, you know, like I really pride myself on growing that part of my game. And, you know, I just haven't been put in a position to where I've had to use it, you know, but I'm prepared to. And I think that's going to shock a lot of people. I think that's going to bring a lot of open a lot of eyes. I think they're going to be like, whoa, this dude's like not just he's not just standing and not trying to knock people out. Like, he can do everything. So I'm excited to show that off, man. I really am.
You know, they always talk about perceptions versus realities. I mean, do you kind of feel like, you know, people, the perception is, hey, Walt is just a stand-up guy. You know, if you go to the ground, you know, is that kind of the biggest thing that you think people take away from you?
Yeah, I think that is. I think of the perception of me as, oh, he can't grapple. You know, and that fuels my fire in the gym every day to prove people wrong. You know what I mean? I think that the Fabricio fight, I got kind of caught in a bad situation where I just didn't train a lick of grappling for 3 months. I did striking for literally 3 months. I don't think I grappled. I probably grappled twice that whole camp just because I knew I was facing a guy who was going to stand up and bang with me. But I did prepare to take him down. You know, I didn't prepare to be taken down. I got caught in between, which is a part of my fault. You know, a lot of it had to do with my old gym. I changed gyms. I wasn't getting what I needed at that gym. So I got caught in the middle of that kind of, okay, we're doing this one thing and this one thing only. And that's why I didn't shine like I wanted to against Fabricio. I had no hesitation taking that fight. I think that's kind of where people see. They're like, oh, okay. When he lost his fights, he was taken down, you know, and he did, you know, they feel like that's where you can beat me, but they're sorely mistaken, you know, that Fabricio is the best to ever do it. So, you know, like grappling with him and grappling with most guys is like two different, it's a night and day difference. But, you know, I just think I have a lot more to show, and I have a lot of things that the fans are going to really, really be impressed with.
In terms of the biggest regret you have in your career, that 3 months of not grappling, is that one of your biggest regrets?
Oh, for sure, bro. Like, that's why I changed gyms, because I realized at that point I was like, I don't give a shit if I trained striking for 3 years. I still should have been prepared to go in there and deal with Fabricio. And I wasn't. You know, I was prepared mentally, physically, but skill-wise, I wasn't ready to go in there and, you know, I knew what to do, but I should have had that going consistently in the background, and it just wasn't there. And that's what kind of, you know, prompted my hand to make the move that I did. So
in terms of this fight, is there anything you want to prove to yourself, you know, in terms of, you know, at UFC 232?
Yeah, I want to prove to myself that I can stomp with the big dogs. You know what I mean? And I know I can. You know, it's just about going in there and going through the motions now. You know, in my head, in my mind, the way I work and what I know I'm capable of, I already know I belong in the top 10. I know I belong to be challenging for a title. I just have to go and do the hard work now, which is getting in the cage and showing it. And I think December 29th, man, people are going to be pleasantly surprised. Oh, my God. Sorry, I'm watching the Bama game.
I've got it on in the other room, but I can hear it. Yeah.
Oh, he almost scored. Oh, my God.
But I mean UFC. I'm not gonna ask you for your pick. So we Jones and Gustafsson.
Jones,
you know,
I'm gonna give you my pick, Jones. That's my dog. Like, that's the dude's unbelievable. Like, it's gonna be a great fight. Don't get me wrong. I love Alexander Gustafsson, but I just don't ever bet against John, man. And I just feel like he has that. He knows what to do to win. Like, it's just. You can't pick against him, man. He finds a way all the time. And he's at a point now, I think, in his career, it's more imperative to prove that he belongs back where he's supposed to be than anything. And I think he's training like that. So,
is he one of those guys you look at and you're just amazed with the things he's able to pull off inside the cage?
Oh, for sure. Like, I steal stuff from him all the time. I told him, I'm like, bro, you got to keep posting videos, because I'm over here swagger jacking everything you do. I see it and I go to the gym and I try it, and I swear. And, you know, we had a good laugh about that. He's like, look, you know, he was joking about, you know, I don't know if you remember, but there was rumors of him coming to heavyweight. And yeah. I told him, I said, look, bro, you come to heavyweight, I'm going to 205. I'm just going to tell you right now. He's like, nah, I'm not coming up there to fool around with your big tail. I'm like, look, I don't. You can say all that all you want, but the minute I hear you sign the heavyweight, I'm cutting weight and I'm going to 205. You know, but I just think he's gifted, man. And his view of the game and the way he sees the fight in the fight, it's almost like Floyd Mayweather. You know what I mean? Like, they can process what's happening at light speed, and they can make adjustments at light speed, and that's what sets him apart. You know, I think he just presents so many different problems for so many different guys in that division that, you know, he's going to rain until he's done raining. He's tired of raining, you know what I mean?
And, of course, your fight here against Andrei Arlovski, UFC 232. Walt, as always, I appreciate time. Let everyone know they can follow you out on social media and those sponsors that help support you.
Oh, man, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at TheBigTicket205, on Facebook at WaltBigTicketHarris. I want to give a shout-out to Bluebird Botanicals, CBDs, for keeping me feeling good and healthy and training hard. I want to thank Jason and Iridium Sports, Ed Cap, everybody over there for helping me and, you know, believing in me. I want to thank everybody at my gym, Spartan Fitness, my bro Eric Anders, who's fighting this weekend. Y'all go check him out. Going to be a great fight, great card. And anybody I forgot, you know who you are, man. I thank you. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate you for having me on, bro.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a man that's going to be fighting for the inaugural Pinnacle FC middleweight title on Saturday night. Pinnacle FC 18, Travis Bam Bam Davis. Travis, I appreciate the time. First off, I got to know, how did you get the nickname Bam Bam? What's the origin of this?
So it actually came from when I was a kid. I did boxing for a little while when I was younger. And one of the, you know, I had bleach blonde hair when I was a kid. And one of the coach's son, I sparred him one day, and I beat him up pretty bad, his son. And he's like, he just said that I reminded him of a little Bam Bam from the Flintstones. And that's kind of just stuck with me through football and everything else. So that's where the name came from.
I was when I knew I was going to talk to you, I was you know researching you up a little bit, and I saw an article. They were talking about this fight, and they were talking about your boxing career, how you went 3-0 in boxing. So what ultimately led you to the MMA path as opposed to the boxing path?
So I started MMA first. I turned pro in boxing about a year and a half ago because I had knee surgery, so I had to take some time off from the MMA and grappling scene. And I said, well, this would be a good time to start working on my hands. And I turned pro about 3 months after the surgery in boxing, won my first fight, then did another one about 3 weeks later and won that one by TKO. And then fought again about 4 months later and won by knockout. But I'm actually looking forward to getting back into the boxing ring. I think my plan is after this fight to try to do one more MMA fight like January, early February, and maybe shoot for boxing in March.
Is it more about just kind of staying active between the two and you know, constantly having fights where maybe, you know, one sport, maybe you can get a fight, you know, in say January, but, you know, it can't come in the other sports or in a couple months. That's what it's more about.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I've actually been on the shelf for like 6 months now. I've had two fights that fell through over the last couple of months. And it's a bit stressful, mainly because, like, the way I look at it, it's, you know, I'm preparing for an MMA fight, and that's, you know, that's always been my dream, is to make it as an MMA fighter, not really a boxer, even though I have a boxing promoter that, you know, keeps wanting to get me to come back to the ring. It's one of those things where, you know, it's so hard to plan a camp for MMA, and then you go through the camp, and then, you know, the fight falls through, and it's like, oh, well, I could have did a boxing fight or something, you know, so definitely like to stay busy and train as much as I can. And that just keeps me healthy, keeps me mentally right, keeps my weight on point. So
now, did the love for MMA come while you were serving as a Marine?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So I started training over there, you know, training the Marines. And then that's when I kind of really got into the grappling aspect. I wrestled for, you know, 13 years when I was younger, but I never did jiu-jitsu, never really knew of any place that I could do that where I was from. And so I immediately fell in love with it. And then I actually went to Thailand, and while I was in Thailand, me and some of my buddies were out drinking, and they talked me into getting into the ring and fighting a Muay Thai fighter. And I got my nose broke and a black eye, but I won the match. The guy was probably half my size. I just dropped him. I dropped him almost every time I would hit him, but he would hit me like 5 or 6 times. So after that, I just immediately went and looked at the first gym I could find, and it just all started from there.
And I also told you own a landscaping company. So has there ever been an interaction with a potential customer or customer once they find out that you're a professional fighter?
Yeah, for sure. You know, some people that aren't familiar with MMA that don't really understand it are kind of like, what do you do that for? You know, like, so you punch each other in the face. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's, you know, all that's involved in training and the fights and everything like that. So it's pretty interesting. On top of, you know, I have a lot of tattoos and stuff. So it's kind of comical when I go to some of these board meetings with condo associations and it's older retired people. And they're just like, who is this guy?
But I mean, that's awesome. Awesome. But you got this title fight here. It's actually the inaugural middleweight title. Josh Trim, 3-1 in his career. You come in, you know, after the fight, unable to go your way against Dom Steele. They always talk about, you know, really it's the times you're not successful that you ultimately learn the most about yourself.
Like, yeah.
Like as you sit back and you think about preparation for this fight, as opposed to, you know, kind of how the last fight went, how would you say you're different now?
Tremendously different. You know, for the Dom Steele fight, the fight kind of came on like 3 weeks notice. I hadn't really been training as much as I should have been because it was the busy season for my landscaping business and I was out on the road doing a lot of work. So I wasn't putting in my time in the gym that I should have been putting in as far as conditioning. My teammates kind of had some issues going on. So I didn't really have my training partners for the camp. So I pretty much did a lot of mitt work and a little bit of drilling stuff with my coach on a regular basis, but I just didn't come in shape. So for this camp, you know, I made it a point to take time away from work. I'm actually downsizing my company going into this next year because I really want to focus on my fight career and where it's going to go next year. So, you know, I've been doing 2-a-days pretty much every day for the last 2 months. I went back and started doing more weightlifting, weight training, conditioning. And I feel good. I mean, I feel the best I've ever felt. You know, I did 5 rounds of hard sparring on Saturday for my last little go. And, you know, I wasn't winded at all. I felt great. You know, and I'm sparring with Dan Spahn and Lance Phillips. So I'm getting good looks and tough guys. And I'm ready to go for this Saturday.
You know, when you look at your opponent, Josh, here, I mean, kind of, you know, break him down for me a little bit. What you see on film?
So what I've seen in film, I've only been able to find a couple of fights on him. You know, a lot of his stuff is older stuff. The most recent one was that I got to watch was him versus his loss to Gidron, Robert Gidron. And, you know, Robert actually just beat my teammate Lance, a fight I thought, you know, Lance should have won and could win. He just got out wrestled, you know, and Lance is a better wrestler than he showed in the fight. And Gidron is clearly a smothering opponent. And he did that to Frim. And Frim, you know, from what I noticed, he's comfortable off his back. He looks for submissions and stuff, but he doesn't really have a lot of urgency to get up. And if you don't get up against me, I'm going to put you to sleep on the ground or I'm going to submit you. You know, that's one difference between me and Gidron is he laid on top of him and kind of just held position most of the rounds. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to punch you in the face until you either give me your neck or you try to get back up. The other thing about him is he's 6'4", tall guy. He's going to have, you know, range on me. I'm only 6 foot. But again, Spahn is one of my training partners. He's 6'4". He's a bigger guy. So I'm fairly used to, seeing that range and length and stuff. You know, Frim's got good head movement and, good boxing from what I've seen. You know, his jab is long, but he kind of paws it out there. So, you know, I've seen plenty of looks and I've been training with plenty of people to give me the look I need for him.
I was going to mention about the height advantage that he does have in this fight. Of those 4 inches, you know, are you expecting that you're going to see a lot of his jab as kind of his way to kind of, you know, not make sure you're not closing the distance? And also, I think naturally we all look at that and say, oh, that's a huge advantage for him.
Yeah, for sure. And I definitely think he's going to use that jab and his kicks. You know, he fights tall and he likes to use those kicks as a range to keep his range and the jab to keep his range. But, you know, I'm just going to double up on my jab and that cross and get inside and bully him around. You know, that's the thing about tall guys, you know, they want to keep it out of range. So just cut the cage work off and put his back against the fence and go to work on him.
What would you outline as, I mean, I know there's multiple keys to victory, but is there anything you would outline as, hey, I've got to do this to walk away with the victory?
Yeah, I just need to, you know, I need to be aggressive. I need to control the cage where he's moving and stuff. And, you know, just let my hands go when I'm ready. And when we go to the ground, you know, I'm very comfortable on the ground. So, you know, if it goes there, then, I mean, he'll be in trouble.
And of course, this is all going down on Saturday night, Pinnacle FC 18 in Pittsburgh. You know, first time fighting out of Columbus, so little road trip. I mean, are you kind of looking forward to that? Of like, you know what? Hey, I got to get on the road.
Honestly, I'm stoked about it. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, you fought in your hometown. Are you going to be nervous? No, I've been wanting to fight out of Columbus. It's just been, you know, it's just been kind of convenient for me getting fights here and stuff like that. And the promoters have treated me well. And, but you know, my first fight as an amateur was in Okinawa, Japan, in front of, you know, a packed place. And I had maybe like 7 or 8 people there to watch me fight. And everyone was cheering against me. I was fighting a Japanese local at the time. So, you know, that stuff just, amps me up. I like it. You know,
I always feel like when we're talking about the regional scene of MMA, it's almost like it's easier for the fighter if they're going somewhere else to fight, because then if you're at home, and look, I talk about the business side of MMA all the time. You're that hometown fighter, you know, you're selling tickets and you got people hit you up, you know, week of the fight trying to get tickets, or you're trying to get money from people, say they'll buy tickets. So to me, I've always looked at it and said, I feel like fighters, like, I'd rather, you know, look, they love fighting at home because there's nothing like fighting at home. But going on the road, it's like, hey, all you got to do is make weight, show up the fight. It's easy.
That's it. And I'm like you said, you hit it, you know, the nail on the head there with the tickets and all that stuff. I mean, it's such a pain to deal with that. And everyone's, like you said, last minute, people are wanting tickets and messaging me. And, you know, as a fighter, you know, coming up in the regional scene, you don't really get paid a lot. So you jump on every opportunity to sell as many tickets as you can to make more money. Man, a couple of people messaged me about this one a couple of weeks ago about tickets. I was like, you know, get online. I ain't dealing with it. You know, don't bother me. I could care less. So
it's unfortunately, it is the business side of being a regional fighter that a lot of people just don't talk about. But Travis, man, I really appreciate time. Look forward to seeing the fight come here on Saturday in Pittsburgh, Pinnacle FC 18. You want some information on the event, the best way to go is just go to the Pinnacle FC Facebook page to get all that. But let everyone know where they can find you on social media and those sponsors that help support you.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm on Facebook under Bam Bam Davis, Instagram under Bam Bam Davis 1. I honestly can't remember what my Twitter handle is, but it's you can find it through one of those other accounts. And then obviously I got to give a shout out to my sponsors, you know, Miss Mary Jane, California, out of CBD out of California, Supzilla, Central House Spine and Joint, 3030 Barbershop. I'm drawing blanks for some reason, you know, I guess I need to look at my fight shorts. So, but you know, everyone who's helped me get through, the camps, keeping me healthy and motivated.
And there was my conversation with Zach Otto, Mike Rodriguez, Walt Harris, and Travis Davis. I appreciate all those fighters giving me some time out this week to talk about either their wins at UFC on Fox 31 or their fights coming up at UFC 232 for Walt Harris and at Pinnacle FC 18 for Travis Davis. All those interviews were done in video form, so you'll be able to check those out on the MMA Report YouTube channel as well. But we want to wrap up this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast talking about two news stories, and I almost feel like we could just classify this as, not surprised. So Nick Diaz does an interview with Ariel Helwani where he says that, the fight at UFC 235 is not set, a.k.a. are we really surprised UFC announced a fight where apparently Nick Diaz hasn't signed on the dotted line? Not surprising. Here are some of the quotes from Nick Diaz that he sent to Ariel Helwani via a text message. Quote, I think it's rude of the UFC to try and lowball me and expect me to negotiate a deal while I'm training for a fight. I'm not going to go down like that. If anybody wants to fight me, they know where to find me. I'm not a hard guy to find. Come get some.
I have a lot going on and on trying to manage a few different businesses. Once things make sense for everybody, they actually have some fighters that they respect and I respect, we can try and come to deal and do a show. That's how I feel. Goes on to later say, as soon as I am in a good place with what I'm working on and things looking the way it should, I'll be happy to give the fans the, what they need. But I think that'll be okay for now with what's out there. There aren't any fights for me until somebody stands out. I'll fight if they can be more reasonable, but really, I don't even think about it. It would make or take what it would or could take. They are the ones tripping. Daniel, yeah, not surprised UFC would clearly make a fight announcement without pretty much having fighters sign on dotted line, which this is UFC's been doing this for years. There are times where you hear where they will announce a fight publicly and the fighters have not signed on the dotted line yet, and it's basically the UFC's way of forcing the fighter to take the fight because all of a sudden, if they don't take it, they kind of the perception is, oh, they're scared to take the fight.
Oh, yeah, and the one guy that you shouldn't do this to, if you're the UFC, is Nick Diaz. I mean, this guy doesn't care that much about getting back in the cage. He likes his money. I would love to see someone take up Nick Diaz. If you want to fight, you know where to find me. Like, is somebody going to show up to Stockton, California and fight Nick Diaz for free? I mean, I wouldn't want to do it, but sounds like a great sequel to Bully Beatdown. How you announce a Nick Diaz fight and think you're going to pressure him into signing is beyond me. I don't need, like, Nick Diaz, Masvidal is a great fight, but I will say, no disrespect to Masvidal, but that's just not the fight to make. If you're going to get Nick Diaz into cage, his opponent has got to be a sure thing rising star, or he's got to be a name or a bigger name fighter, because you're only going to have some.
He wants Woodley. That's what he wants. And Woodley wants that fight. I think there's no question both sides want it. I mean, the whole welterweight division right now in the UFC, I mean, you've got, you know, obviously 233 being canceled. So Askren Lawler is now in March. The whole Covington Usman thing. And I just like, I'm like, oh, God, let's have these guys fight each other. I mean, you know, Woodley, whenever he's ready, I mean, look, to me, I'd love to see Colby Covington and Kamaru Usman. This is a fight that's been, you know, really been in the makings for years. But, you know, I mean, look, if Colby Covington was, quote unquote, the interim welterweight champion, he should get Woodley. What I mean, look, and whatever your thoughts are on Colby Covington, I mean, look, he should get the title shot.
Yes, he absolutely should. I mean, he's got the fake title. Give him the title shot. And I think it's got to be Covington, Woodley, and then you look at Usman. You know, Nick Diaz, Woodley would be a big fight. I probably shouldn't do it, but there are other opportunities, I think, in the works. So, I think that's kind of – the welterweight picture is really weird. It seems like Dana White hates everybody in the welterweight division. I don't know who he actually likes. But
it was like, Usman talking about how he'll roll through, Askren and how he knocked him out. And I'm like, it's not like you've had knockouts in the UFC. You've had one. It's very interesting how Ben Askren was this guy Dana White just didn't like. But now all of a sudden he loves him because Ben's like, I'll fight whoever. Just have him sign on the dotted line. I'll show up.
Yeah. It's like. Maybe unblock the guy on Twitter.
It's just amazing the fact that it was that long ago Dana White hates Ben Askren, but all of a sudden now Ben's in the UFC and he'll fight whenever you want him to fight. Oh, I'm all about it. Like, I think there is clearly dudes in the UFC welterweight division that do not want to see Ben Askren across the cage from him because they know what's going to happen. If he gets you to the ground, you're not getting up.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you. I think, Ben Askren is going to be an interesting addition to the UFC and not for the fighters. I mean, he's going to go out there. He's going to put you on the ground. He's going to make it uncomfortable and brutal. And, he could be like the boring version of Cowboy Cerrone when it's all said and done, just continuing to take every fight, but not necessarily doing it in the most entertaining fashion.
Yeah. By the way, in the other not so shocking news department, Vitor Belfort coming out of retirement, going to fight in 2019. When he announced that on Monday, I was like, yep, not surprised.
Yeah, this dude's retired 47 times, and that's how old he actually is, probably.
Here's a question.
Uh-huh.
if you were going to put a betting line out there, are we talking like Ryzen's like a 5-1 favorite?
Oh, yeah. That's where he should fight, and that's where I would feel the best, because I think he would go out there and beat up bums.
So you
and that's
feel, what I want to see. You feel like TRT Vitor's coming back, huh?
Mm-hmm. I think Ryzen or 1FC. I mean, those are the two smack dab favorites.
Oh, by the way, speaking of 1FC, so, you know, how they were claiming about their great television deal?
Yes.
Not so great after the details come out on this thing.
What are the details?
So it is, at the end of the day, it is a streaming deal. This is what it is. So this was last Thursday. They sent a press release out. And I'll give you the three bullet points here at the very top of the press release. Turner Sports reaches multi-year agreement with One Championship beginning in January 2019. TNT to televise One Championship content throughout the year. Turner's BR Live to distribute One Championship live events starting in January 2019. So here gives you a little bit further details on it. So BR Live, which is Turner's streaming service, will distribute shoulder programming surrounding the live event experience. Additionally, Turner's TNT will televise at least 12 one-hour taped re-airs featuring One Championship events per year. So basically, it's going to be another streaming service you're going to have to buy to watch One Championship events. And quite honestly, when One Championship was free on their app, I didn't watch.
Yeah, I understand. It is a different One Championship, though, because they do have guys.
Oh, the way this deal was presented before the details came out, man, like, oh my God, they're going to be on TNT. Deals come out, it's like, oh, it's just re-airs. And here's the question. Is it going to be re-airs like at 2 o'clock in the morning? That's my question.
It's got to be at 1:30. I mean, hey, man. If I
was One Championship, if it's going to re-air at late night, you know when I want it?
After an NBA game.
Correct. Right after the post game show, because look, in terms of studio shows, TNT's NBA studio show is by far the best, and there's no one close to them.
It's the one post game show that people actually stay to watch
because you don't know what might be said, because you know Barkley and Shaq are going to shoot one line. The thing I love the best about that show is how they incorporate fan tweets about what's being said and like funny gifts.
Yeah, I love that. Well, my favorite part is just the interaction between the guys, but it's the one show where you're bumper programming and you can feel good about being bumper programming to a post game show.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, yeah, that TV deal is not great. I mean, well, it's not game changing.
No.
That's for sure. That's for absolute sure.
Like I, you know, there is this thought, you know, and I saw some people, you know, saying this the other day, like what happens if the streaming bubble burst, what's that going to mean for combat sports?
It's not going to be great. And I think the bubble will burst, but I just don't know what's going to happen. Dude, I think we're just going to stop watching TV.
Daniel,
stop
I'll tell watching. You, ever since I got rid of DirecTV and now I have YouTube TV, don't miss DirecTV at all. Don't.
Yeah. I mean, people are going to have to make decisions, though, because you buy YouTube TV, then you buy UFC, then you buy.
Oh, look. I have YouTube TV, so it's $45 a month. Do love the unlimited DVR. That's a big selling point of it. So I've got UFC Fight Pass right now, which I'm going to cancel at the end of this month, because they're as of this moment, they have not given me any reasons why I need Fight Pass in January 2019. Sorry, I'm not having Fight Pass to watch regional MMA. Sorry. Not what I want Fight Pass for. I've got Fight Pass for UFC events. Now, if they do a card on Fight Pass, I'll purchase it that month. But in terms of every month aspect, I have no reason for Fight Pass in January 2019. So I've got that. I've got DAZN, so that's $10 a month. But that's how I watch Bellator since Paramount is not a part of YouTube TV, and I have Netflix and I have Amazon Prime Video.
And you're going to keep it there. You're not going to buy the Bleacher Report stream.
As of right now, why am I going to get the Bleacher Report stream? What's on there that I have to have?
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's only Demetrius Johnson, Eddie Alvarez, which are big pools, but I don't know if it's enough. It probably
Who are they fighting?
That's ultimately got to be the thing, is if I'm going to basically essentially buy internet pay-per-view to watch them fight, A, who are they fighting, and B, what early goddamn time do I got to get up on a Saturday morning to watch that fight?
Yeah, man. I'm absolutely not going to be watching these live. Look,
and during the week, I'm an early riser, okay? This morning, I'm up at 5 a.m. I'm an early riser, but on Saturdays, I try to sleep in a little bit.
Yeah. Don't take the sleep away from Jason. He only gets about 3 hours a night.
No, what are you talking about? Nah, dude, I'm up after 10. If you text me after 10 o'clock East Coast time, there's a good chance you're not getting a response.
Yeah, that's usually when I wake up.
I sit there, I'll wake up, I'll check my phone, I'll see text messages, and I sit there, and I have to have the casual thought, Jason, it's 5 o'clock. Do you really want to be texting that person back at this point?
They texted you when you were asleep. You can do it too.
I know. I'm kind of compassionate with that stuff. I'm like, but then the thing will be like, it'll be like noon. I'm like, oh crap. I need to text that person back.
Oh yeah. That absolutely does happen.
Yeah. I mean, it allows me to get a lot of things done. And sometimes I try to get out of the office by like 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That doesn't always happen though. Doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
You know, so, but yeah, it's, but I'm going to enjoy, I'll be in Dallas this weekend for, Bucks Cowboys. And so, for anyone who's never been to Cowboys Stadium, that Jumbotron is big, but you don't realize how big it is until you actually walk in that stadium.
It's huge. It's absolutely ginormous.
Best part about the broadcast booth that we're in, you have a bathroom in the broadcast booth.
And
you know this, that when you're working a game broadcast, that's one of the first things you look for is, okay, how close is the bathroom if I need a run during a commercial break?
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Like, I'm a man who's got to pee, and that's I'm not one of those guys who's going to hold it in for 4 hours, you know? I'm not wearing an adult diaper, so... So that sounds great. That's such a broadcasting thing, that the one thing in this beautiful stadium that you love is the bathroom proximity.
You're literally in a suite. I mean, it's huge. I mean, it's got to be one of the biggest booths in all the NFL. It's amazing. That stadium's unbelievable. This will be, I think, I want to say my third time that I'm going to the new Cowboy Stadium. I remember I was not a big fan of the old Cowboy Stadium. The elevator only went to a certain point, and that point didn't get you to the broadcast booths. So we were carrying gear up 2 flights of stairs.
That's awful. That's a shame.
And I sat there and I was like, God, could I imagine if I worked for the Cowboys Radio Network and I had to do this every week?
Yeah, or broadcast.
Oh, look, I would have made the executive decision. Fellas, we're having equipment that lives here.
Yep, absolutely. Or a storage room at the top. I can't imagine doing the broadcast Olympics climbing up 2 types of stairs to all that equipment.
Yeah, but of course, we will be back next Wednesday, the day after Christmas, to preview UFC 232. Jones, Gustafsson, there's actually a conference call this week with both those guys. Cyborg Nunez. Were you the only one that found it interesting? I don't know if it was on Saturday's broadcast or the week before. With Cormier talking about, yeah, the fight I'm most interested in is Nunez Cyborg. And I'm like, okay, DC. Come on, you're not at all interested in Jones Gustafsson? Come on. They're fighting for the title that will no longer be yours in a week.
The difference is between, like, a huge payday and a huge, huge, huge payday. I mean, that's money right there in the cage when Jones and Gustafsson fights. Money in DC's bank account that might not be there if Gustafsson wins.
I mean, say whatever you want about John Jones. I'm a fan of greatness. And, I think we're really going to never know, really about John Jones of what would have happened, without all these issues. But, I'm interested in seeing that fight. I mean, Cyborg Nunez, interested in that one. We got Chiesa moving up to 170 pounds to take on, Carlos Condit. We got Ira Latifi against Corey Anderson. Chad Mendez against Alexander Volkanovski. That is a fight I have circled. You know, that's a huge matchup in the featherweight division. We're looking forward to that one. Cassingano, Megan Anderson. That's definitely another fight. Douglas Silva de Andrade, Peter Yan. That's a fight. Fight I'm not interested in is BJ Penn, Ryan Hall.
Absolutely. That one sticks out like a sore thumb. It's a huge pimple, and it's just like, don't put BJ in the cage. Fortunately, Ryan Hall is a killer striker, so at least there's that aspect where you can feel better that it's just going to be a grappling contest. But yeah, that's the one downside of the card.
Bavon Lewis, Uriah Hall on the Fight Pass prelims. That's definitely a fight that has me interested. Bavon Lewis, I mean, literally, if you were going to put a John Jones clone at 185 pounds, that'd be him. Fights just like him, trains at Jackson Wink. That is definitely a fight that has me interested. So looking forward next week talking about those fights. Really looking for that fight card. And that's gonna be next Saturday is gonna be a busy day in sports. We've got the college football playoffs, and we got UFC 232 at night. It's gonna be a good day of watching sports.
Absolutely. If you're a fan, get your wings and get your beer. We will get your recommendations on what you need to order from your favorite wing establishment. I cannot wait. And it's, one of the biggest cards of the year because of those top two fights. And, man, I'm so looking forward to it.
Yeah, same here. Of course, we'll be back next Wednesday. As always, Daniel, great talking MMA with you. Of course, you can always follow Daniel on Twitter at DanielGalvonDGG. Always great to follow Daniel on Instagram. You can see his interactions with his dog, which is always pretty hilarious. Of course, you can always follow me on all social media platforms. I'm at Jason_Floyd. Of course, if you're not subscribed to this podcast, you can do that on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play. Of course, and podcasts are always available every Wednesday on RadioInfluence.com.
This is the Landry Football with Chris Landry. Quick fix on Radio Influence.
I'm as excited as anybody for signing day. Not for the event of signing day. I'm not really big into the event. I'm not really big of kids showing up with five hats and deciding which one he's going to put on. I think that's, I'm old school. But I think we've gotten to the point now where we're making celebrities out of these guys, and then we wonder why they're full of themselves and why they care more about themselves. We're living in a world where it is about look at me. It is about what's in it for me. I get it. I understand it. I don't want to be overly critical, but that's the reason why, you know, we've gone down this path, and that's the reason why they don't want to play in bowl games. They want to look out for themselves. The money is great. Listen, money is the root of all evil if you think about it. It's not evil. Money's not evil. Money is good. Capitalism is good. But when we make it to where it's more about that and we don't do things and handle things the right way, then it becomes not an evil situation, but it can become very negative.
Chris Landry brings you Landry Football every week on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, RadioInfluence.com.